content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. Our first article today is about criminal justice. An inmate's unlikely ally. A growing number of people in Lexington have lobbied to the governor's office to free Charles McNear, who says he was wrongfully convicted of rape 25 years ago. He has a surprising new supporter, the police chief. More than 45 years ago, Lexington police detectives helped put Charles McNear behind bars for a rape he has long maintained he didn't commit. Now the town's current police chief says Governor Josh Stein should consider strongly granting McNear's clemency. In April, Chief Robbie Rummage sent a letter to Stein's office raising questions about McNear's continued incarceration and the lack of information surrounding the police investigation that led to his 1980 conviction for second-degree rape and burglary. Rummage's letter, which has not been previously reported, represents a 360-degree turn for a department whose officers, McNear said, beat him during a November 1979 interrogation. Rummage wrote that in his 26 years in law enforcement, he has helped investigate murders resulting in long prison sentences for defendants. But some of those convicted murderers have since been released, while McNear remains behind bars. The police department no longer has the criminal investigative file. It may have been destroyed in the late 1980s based on state-mandated retention schedules, but no one recorded the file's destruction. What remains is a troubling gap. We have no documentation of the investigation that led to Mr. McNear's life sentence, Rummage wrote. The limited materials we do have do not present a coherent narrative and do not pertain to the offence in question. The Assembly wrote about McNear's case in 2023. Rummage said he personally investigated whether the file existed at that time after we asked a judge to release it. McNear, who is black, was 16, illiterate and poor at the time of his arrest, and he lived in a segregated city where the Ku Klux Klan had marched through downtown just months earlier. Lexington's elected district attorney, the late Butch Zimmerman, was known to regale criminal defense attorneys with tales of slave owners raping enslaved black women and to have a collection of Confederate memorabilia in his office. McNear was accused of breaking into a 57-year-old white woman's house and raping her while holding a hammer and a screwdriver. Police officials then attempted to link him to four other unsolved attacks on white women without any apparent evidence. In the November 1979 incident, McNear says his lawyer gave him a stark choice: plead guilty and receive a life sentence, or take his chances at trial and possibly get the death sentence. At that time, there was no death penalty for rape, but McNear took the deal and has been in prison ever since. Rummage says McNear has received significant local support and wouldn't have received a life sentence if he were convicted of the same crimes today. A defendant convicted on those charges today would likely face a maximum of 10 years in prison. Given these facts, I find it difficult to reconcile why Mr. McNear's case has not received more meaningful consideration for clemency or release, he said. Rummage's letter shocked McNear. I never knew a police chief would believe somebody like me, he said in a brief phone interview from Randolph Correctional Center. He had recently been transferred there from Catawba Correctional Center, where he had spent nearly 16 months. Most of them kind of stick together, he said, but you know, he stuck his neck out there. Jamie Lau, McNear's attorney and a supervising attorney at Duke Law's Wrongful Convictions Clinic, said this is the first time he has seen a law enforcement officer raise concerns like this, but it's difficult to know how much of an impact Rummage's letter will have on the governor's office. I would hope that a letter from the police chief would be significant to the governor's office, he said. Meeting in Raleigh. Wanda Cox, a former showroom and interior designer who had emerged as one of McNear's most passionate advocates, and other Lexington supporters tried for months to get former Governor Roy Cooper to grant McNear clemency before leaving office. In September 2022, Lau filed a clemency petition with the Juvenile Sentence Review Board, which Cooper established via executive order to revisit sentences handed down to minors. That executive order expired the moment Cooper left office on January 1st. Cooper's Task Force for Racial Equality and Criminal Justice pushed for the creation of the board, and his executive order noted that 80% of people sent to prison for crimes they committed as teenagers are racial minorities. As Attorney General, Stein was co-chair of the task force. Nearly 200 inmates filed clemency petitions with the board. Cooper commuted the sentences of 14, said Ben Finholt, a clemency and parole expert at the Wilson Center of Science and Justice at Duke Law. Another 14 completed their sentences and were released before Cooper made a decision. The board denied 88 petitions. Finholt said another 75 are now pending before Stein, including McNear's, according to data Finholt received from the Governor's Clemency Office. McNear's supporters met with members of Stein's staff on June 17th, including Cox, Lexington Mayor Jason Hayes, City Council member Garrett Holloway, Reverend Alan Suber, President of the Lexington Chapter of the NAACP, Reverend Lester Smith, an Associate Pastor at Union Baptist Church, Reverend Ray Morgan with the Western North Carolina Conference of the United Methodist Church, Cheryl Leverett Lide, who is running for Lexington School Board, and local activist Tyrone Terry. Cox said Stein's staff urged them to be patient. "I thought Charles has been very patient," Cox said she told them. She said staff has told her that Stein's administration is still new and they are reviewing McNear's petition, but that she was never given a clear answer on whether Stein would re-establish the Juvenile Sentence Review Board. Cox said she is frustrated. "We're now in the 46th year of incarceration," she said. "When is it enough?" Stein's spokesperson, Morgan Hopkins, would not comment specifically on McNear's case or offer a timeline for review, nor did she address whether Stein will re-establish the review board. All of the petitions submitted to the North Carolina Juvenile Sentence Review Board previously will be reviewed in due course, she said in a statement. Missing file. After more than four decades, McNear's case is clouded in mystery and bereft of easy answers. Many of the main players have long since died, and there's no record of the criminal investigation. Here's what we know. McNear was 16 and said he met the 57-year-old woman he was accused of raping in October 1979. He was hustling for tips outside the Winn-Dixie store in exchange for carrying customers' groceries to their cars. McNear had dropped out of school to help his family. He said he and the woman became friends. She told him about her estranged husband and they hung out, drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana together. Sometimes he would visit her at her house in the 800 block of Fairview Drive in East Lexington. McNear said that's what he was doing on November 25, 1979, dressed in striped khakis, a thin brown dress shirt and tassel loafers. The woman offered him alcohol and marijuana and told him he had to leave by 12:30 a.m. because she was expecting someone. He said the two started kissing, but he passed out. He could not remember if he had sex with her. All he knew was that he awoke to Roy Owens, a Lexington police officer, beating him on the head and putting him in handcuffs. McNear said he was hauled off to the downtown police station where officers kept hitting him and demanding a confession. "I felt like they were going to hang me," McNear said in 2023. At McNear's sentencing, Lexington Police Lieutenant Harold Caudle read a statement from the woman. She said at 4 a.m. she woke up to see McNear nude and standing by her bed. She said he was holding a claw hammer and a screwdriver, and she recognized McNear clearly under the illumination of a streetlight. After he raped her, she said he fell asleep in her bed. She slipped out, went to a neighbour's house and called the police. The Assembly tried to piece together what happened all those years ago for our 2023 investigation, but much of the information is missing, lacks details, or suggests a contradicting set of allegations against McNear. The alleged victim died in 1992. The primary detectives and the prosecutor have died as well. The alleged victim had three children. Two are deceased, but one daughter lives in Lexington. She did not respond to a request for comment. The Assembly filed a motion asking the judge to release the criminal investigative file, which is not a public record. We learned the Lexington Police Department no longer had the file, but did have a different investigative file from another alleged rape in August 1979. McNear was not charged in that case. Rummage said in an April 15th interview that it bothered him that there was so little information about the case. He said McNear's supporters have raised legitimate questions about the case. There's no way I can fathom an explanation for why his case did not rise to the level of clemency, he said. Confidential process. Lau, McNear's attorney, said he doesn't know how much Rummage's letter will help because the whole clemency review process is confidential. He said he has no idea whether the Juvenile Sentence Review Board reviewed McNear's petition and made a recommendation to Cooper. Considering that the petition was filed in September 2022, Lau said it is inconceivable that the board hadn't evaluated it before Cooper left office. He said there's no communication about the decision-making process, and it's not exactly clear how Stein's administration will handle the pending petitions, including McNear's. Advocates have criticised the board for its lack of transparency and slow review process. Lau said the police chief's letter reflects the support McNear has from the community. Often, prosecutors argue that a jury's verdict should be the final say on guilt or innocence. In a way, the community has rendered a new verdict for McNear, Lau said, expressing through Lexington's leaders, the police chief and everybody calling for the end of Mr. McNear's incarceration. And this article is by Michael Hewlett. Our next article is entitled In Asheville, a Natural Disaster and a Housing Crisis Collide. This is by Jessica Wakeman. The city saw an increase in the number of people living on the street after Helene. For some, it was their first brush with homelessness. Heavy rains had been drenching western North Carolina for over the final week of September 2024. On that Thursday night, Ursula Crawford was fixing dinner at her West Asheville rental when water and mud started seeping under her door. Within minutes, the apartment filled, Crawford recalled. She placed her caramel-coloured dachshund, Ginger, on the bed and called her landlord, who booked them a hotel room. But as Hurricane Helene pounded the region throughout that night and the following morning, the apartment Crawford had lived in for 4 years was rendered uninhabitable. A year later, the 74-year-old is still without a home. After multiple relocations, Crawford and Ginger now live in a homeless shelter in West Asheville, where they share a room with five other people. It's her first time living in a shelter. She's not alone. Housing is the top self-identified unmet need, Helene survivors have reported to North Carolina Emergency Management Disaster Case Management. According to Buncombe County's Helene Recovery Plan, 372 residential units were destroyed during the storm, about half of them rentals. And while federal programs exist to help homeowners rebuild, there are fewer options for people in other housing situations. Last fall, the legislature allocated $1 million for rental assistance to the 26 storm-impacted counties. And while Buncombe County and Asheville have provided additional assistance, it hasn't been nearly enough to address the need, said State Representative Lindsay Prather, a Democrat who represents Buncombe County. Our legislature should and could have provided more help to renters in Western North Carolina after the storm, she wrote via email. Instead, we have further exacerbated the ongoing housing crisis in this region. Who is homeless? In Buncombe County, the sudden crisis of a natural disaster collided with the slow-moving crisis of homelessness. People who run shelters and provide provide related services who spoke to the Assembly say anecdotally they believe the population of unhoused folks in Asheville has risen since Helene, but exact figures are hard to determine. I don't know that anybody has those numbers, said Beth Trigg of Swannanoa Communities Together, a non-profit organisation supporting people displaced by the storm. Asheville maintains a homeless management information system which providers update when people who are unhoused access services. But it's still hard to give more than a day-by-day count, said Buncombe County Homelessness Programme Manager Lacey Hoyle. I don't even know if that would be accurate, she said, because not every service provider participates. Many people who are part of that programme are fairly transient and they move from area to area as they're able, she said. The nearest reliable estimate, or at least the one the federal government relies on, is the point-in-time count, which is conducted over 2 days every January. In 2025, the count put Asheville's unhoused population at 755, up from 739 in 2024. But with that marginal increase, a more concerning trend was hiding. A 50% increase in the number of people who were unsheltered. That figure covers people staying in cars and tents rather than shelters. 35% of them cited Helene as the reason they were on the street. Service providers are careful to note that there are other factors contributing to housing insecurity in Asheville. A recent community survey found that 17,000 total renter households in Buncombe County spend more than 30% of their income on housing, and 7,000 spend more than 50%. Further exacerbating the crisis is Asheville's economy, which is largely tourism-based. Both gig and service workers suffered from the downturn following the storm. Lodging sales, a broad metric for measuring tourism, is down about $20 million in 2025 compared with 2024. Asheville had already become a popular second home destination with numerous luxury houses and apartments more suited to a snowbird's bank account than that of a waitress. But something is different among the unhoused population post-Helene, said Asheville Poverty Initiative Executive Director Ben Williamson. Prior to the storm, some of Asheville's homeless people seemed to embrace freedom and choice to live on the street, he said, despite the struggles of the experience. Now it feels like it's more desperate. Crawford never anticipated becoming homeless. I grew up in a little middle-class neighbourhood. I went to a private school. And here I am, you just never know. She had been a social work case manager for children in foster care and people with disabilities for 40 years in New York and New Jersey. She also worked in food service. Throughout her life, Crawford and her late mother frequently visited Western North Carolina, leading her to settle in Asheville in 2011. Crawford drove for Uber until her car was destroyed by a drunk driver before Helene. She was a cook at the Comfort Inn and staffed the North Carolina State Fair every year. She has always worked, often two jobs at a time. After Helene struck, Crawford's landlord paid for 10 days in a hotel. The landlord also moved some of Crawford's possessions, including a grill and a kayak, into a storage space. Crawford assumed she'd move back into her apartment eventually, but on November 14th, she learned she couldn't return. My landlord had sent me a message saying that it was going to be a while. And then she was going to jack up the rent to $1,200. I'm like, oh man. She had been paying $825 before the storm. Around Thanksgiving, Crawford went to Cincinnati to stay with family. Her relatives' work schedules made it an agonizing 6 weeks, she recalled, as both worked the second shift. Trigg, a Swannanoa Communities Together, said it's common to see people who lost their housing due to Helene being displaced multiple times as circumstances change. Crawford returned to Asheville in February after a conversation with a FEMA representative who told her she qualified for a hotel stay through May. On that day, I reserved a room for 3 months at a hotel, Crawford recalled. Standing at the front desk is when I was told the FEMA rep gave me wrong information and I didn't qualify. She said FEMA did offer her a hotel room in Flat Rock, a neighbourhood in Hendersonville that is about a half-hour drive from Asheville. Well, I don't have a car, said Crawford. How am I going to get to Flat Rock? Crawford said she spent a lot of my money for a few weeks, covering 10 days in a hotel room out of pocket for $1,500, but she realised it wasn't sustainable. She also noted that due to recovery groups coming to town, it was difficult to find a hotel room near Asheville. She hadn't been successful finding affordable housing, despite making 27 phone calls regarding rentals. I'm like, well, wait a minute, where's the $900 places? She said, there aren't any $900 places. Crawford also visited Buncombe County's Helene Resource Centre in downtown Asheville, but was unimpressed. They just give you a list of housing projects. Crawford said she received $2,700 from FEMA to replace some of her possessions, which is also helping cover the $250 a month cost of her storage unit. But she didn't qualify for any other resources, she said, because FEMA determined that her house was habitable, she just can no longer afford it. After a few weeks, Crawford decided to move on from relying on the goodwill of friends and family and started looking at shelters. But most of Asheville's shelters don't allow pets, and she was not going to abandon her dog. Around the same time, Ginger started peeing blood. The 7-year-old dachshund needed surgery to remove 3 bladder stones. Crawford relied on a new credit card, a FEMA disbursement, and money from a friend to pay the $2,000 bill. As much as I love my Ginger, the decision to keep her has had disadvantages, she admitted. Even though it was still winter, Crawford seriously considered sleeping on the street with Ginger. In late February, she was referred to Safe Shelter, which does accept animals. Now Crawford is one of 6 women sharing a bedroom converted from a classroom in a former Montessori school. She's found it difficult at times to negotiate shared lights and temperature. As a lung and breast cancer survivor, she's concerned about pneumonia. The shelter also requires guests to vacate for 6 hours each day to do a deep cleaning. That has been particularly hard on Sundays, when nearby West Asheville Library, where she likes to pass the time, is closed. Still, Crawford said she's learned a lot from her sheltering experience. She said she previously knew nothing about fentanyl, but has now met several people in recovery. I've had to learn to relate to lots of different types of people. One resource that didn't flow in after Helene was housing assistance. Although imperfect, FEMA programs could be accessed by people who had housing before the storm. Renters were, at the very least, able to use FEMA funds to replace belongings or cover short-term hotel stays. But things remained status quo for unhoused people who didn't qualify for federal disaster programs, Triggs said. Williamson of the Asheville Poverty Initiative put it bluntly, "There is no money for that." Beyond case management services, unhoused people have very little access to federal or state support. Following a natural disaster, Trigg explained. She noted that Swannanoa Communities Together has helped people who were unhoused acquire new tents, or in some cases campers, as have Homeward Bound and beloved Asheville. Immediately after the storm, Asheville's unhoused population was able to use the temporary shelters that popped up alongside other displaced residents. The Red Cross established shelters at a Gold's Gym location, Swannanoa First Baptist Church, Trinity Baptist Church, Asheville Buncombe Technical Community College, and the Western North Carolina Agricultural Center. At its peak, 585 people displaced by Helene sheltered at 3 locations in Asheville one night in early October. But those shelters closed one by one as people found other places to live or return to their homes. In late fall, only the location at the Gold's Gym remained, and it closed December 31st. FEMA's Transitional Sheltering Assistance Program, or TSA, housed 13,317 displaced households in hotels through May. That program is intended for people whose housing was damaged or destroyed in a natural disaster. But in the chaos immediately following a storm, it has provided rooms to unhoused people too. But as FEMA began reviewing TSA eligibility in January, it deemed those who were homeless before the storm ineligible, meaning they had to move out of their hotel rooms or pay for them themselves. They were identifiable in part because many of them listed a day centre as their main address, according to Kinsella of Homeward Bound, which operates the centre. Many in the homelessness services community hope Helene could provide a reset for how the city serves its least resourced. What we had before didn't work for a lot of people, said Williamson. Asheville and Buncombe County could use the rebuilding funds to provide affordable housing, accessible bathrooms, and improved public transit if leaders don't squander the opportunity. Williamson admitted to feeling defeated now that much of the surplus resources after Helene are gone. There's no 24/7 bathroom, there's no showers. Donations have also slowed for the non-profit Western Carolina Rescue Ministries, which operates an overnight shelter, and finances have gotten pinched, Woods says. Monetary donations are definitely not coming in anymore, said Trigg. We can see the funding cliff coming. For now, Crawford and Ginger are on several waiting lists for rentals. I'm not going to get excited about it yet, she said, because everything just seems to take forever. The reality is that there is a 6 month to a year wait list. Crawford said she will look for a job again once she's settled in her own place, primarily because of Ginger. I can't take her to work. In the meantime, she volunteers for 12 Baskets Cafe, the free cafe operated by the Asheville Poverty Centre. She's taking free tap dance classes at a recreation centre, and she's dreaming about a goal she had even before Helene hit. Moving to Panama. Rent is cheaper there. So this report was put together by Jessica Wakeman, who is a freelance reporter based in Asheville. And the report was written in September 2026 and is a special report of the Assembly. I hope you've enjoyed learning more in depth about our state and what's happening in the state. There are many more in-depth reports from the Assembly, and I'm looking forward to sharing them with you in future weeks. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, and if you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138, and you have been listening to The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com.